again, Kevin Z's Presente. Thank you for your work. We're gone.
Community radio station, KBOO Portland. Before we get going with our programming, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroix Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Thank you.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jonathan Safran Foer, whose latest book is We Are the Weather, Saving the Planet Begins at Breakfast. He is the author of three novels, Here I Am, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Everything is Illuminated, and one earlier nonfiction work, Eating Animals. Have I left anything out there?
I've done a couple of odd smaller books here and there. The first book I ever did was actually an anthology of writing about Joseph Cornell's bird boxes. I did a book called Tree of Codes, which was I started with Bruno Schulz's Street of Crocodiles and removed a bunch of words until what remained told a different story. I, of course, edited New American Haggadah, which I'm sure you use every Passover and most nights in between.
This particular book, We Are the Weather, is in a way a sequel to Eating Animals, at least in my mind. Eating Animals mostly dealt with factory farming, with, I believe, there was probably some reference to climate in there. But this book, we go full tilt on the effects of animal husbandry, particularly factory farming, on the climate and the weather. Why it isn't just fossil fuels, why it is the way we eat. And I talked to you about eating animals. After that, now I only get cage-free chicken and cage-free eggs. But we're going one step further here, which we'll get to in a minute. But first, I want to go back and let you talk a little bit about the relationship of climate and eating meat.
So I don't think of this as a sequel to Eating Animals, and I think of the echoes, which are obvious and totally undeniable. Both books take animal agriculture as their focus. I think of those echoes as unfortunate because it makes it harder to believe, maybe, the argument that I am trying to make, which is that with respect to climate change, our food choices are at least as important as any other choices. They're not important in such a way that we should stop paying attention to the other things, but we have to include this among the things that we pay attention to. So according to the United Nations, which is not PETA, Animal agriculture is one of the top two or three causes of every significant environmental problem on the planet, locally and globally. Air pollution, water pollution, deforestation, loss of biodiversity, topsoil erosion. They published a study called Livestock's Long Shadow, which is, if anybody who is listening to this cares to learn more, that's a great place to start. In the most recent IPCC report, the authors said that even if we were to do everything else that we're talking about to save the planet, we have no hope of meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Accords unless we also dramatically reduce the amount of meat that we eat. So we know that there are four things that an individual can do that matter more than everything else, and in fact, far more than everything else. Those four are having fewer babies, controlling the population somehow, flying less, living car-free as opposed to just getting a hybrid, and eating a plant-based diet. Most people listening to this are probably not right at this moment in the process of choosing whether or not to have another kid. Otherwise, why would they be listening to this, right? 85% of Americans drive to work, and most of our cities were built to require cars. More than half of the flights that we take are either for work or for non-leisure personal purposes. So we have to do less of those things, but it's not simple. It's certainly not as easy as saying, hey, start right now. Food is a little different because we have the ability to make a choice. For almost all of us, it's an unconstrained choice, especially when taking into account the fact that it's cheaper to eat less meat. And it's the only one of those four activities that immediately addresses methane and nitrous oxide, which are the two most powerful greenhouse gases. So just to take a step back, I find that when talking about this book, often people say to me, so what's your argument? So you're trying to tell us that, and this book actually doesn't have an argument per se. It's sharing what is uncontroversial information.
A large segment of the book consists of a dialogue between you and yourself regarding what this all means and what we can do. And of course, for me, the big question, and it's the big question in the book, is if I forego, let's say, an egg tomorrow morning for breakfast and instead go out and buy tofu and cook that instead, how will that one egg make a difference, even if I take away the eggs completely from my diet?
Tofu is a bit of a straw man. It's unfortunate that you gave tofu as the alternative. There are a lot of other things you could eat instead of an egg. So nothing would change if you don't eat that egg, just as nothing will change if you shoplift tomorrow, and nothing will change if you don't vote. You know, if we just look at our individual actions as citizens out of the context of A, the lives that we live, B, the accumulation of our choices, and C, how those choices participate in waves and social contagions, then yeah, none of them matter at all. And we should all be pretty reckless in our lives and go grab whatever you can hold in your hands and mouth. But we live in communities, and as our behaviors change collectively, which they do all the time, this is not like an unprecedented thing, we're now eating vastly more meat and animal products than we did 50 years ago. We've proven that we can change in that direction. First of all, there are real-world implications. There are real-world effects. The less meat we eat, the less cattle will be raised, the less methane and nitrous oxide will be produced, and the less quickly the earth will warm. But as importantly, and maybe even more importantly, when we exercise our choices, the culture and ultimately the government respond. So, you know, you hear a lot of, well, why should the U.S. do anything because China's not doing anything? And even more, I hear from friends, you know, why should I do anything when this is a systemic problem and only the government can fix it? The government isn't fixing it, and the government is not going to fix it, not anytime soon. And I don't just mean Trump. You know, Obama was not fixing it, and I find it radically hard to imagine any of the Democratic presidential candidates fixing it unless the culture changes to require it being fixed. Marches are a really powerful way to require change, top-down change, but it's not as powerful as changing our behaviors when those behaviors involve money. You know, I met a lot of farmers when I was running Eating Animals who said to me, I grow what people buy. It's not like I'm growing what I think people should eat. I'm growing what people buy, and corporations sell what people buy. A lot of people probably both of the people having this conversation right now have been alarmed looking at images of the Amazon burn. And that alarm usually morphs into anger at Bolsonaro and maybe at Trump. 91% of the Amazon's deforestation is for animal agriculture, period, to create land for livestock to graze or to create land to grow crops for livestock to eat. If you could imagine a global boycott of beef, if you could just imagine American students boycotting beef, that would be the most effective way to save the Amazon. That's not going to happen. But there are already these really obvious arcs of behavioral change. You know, there are more vegetarians on American college campuses now than Catholics, and more vegetarians than any major of study, like English, physics, economics. And that pushes things, I think. I think that is our most forceful way of pushing things between elections.
Jonathan Safran Foer, let me give you two examples. Gluten-free. I happen to have been diagnosed with celiac when I was a little kid, so wheat is out of the question for me. For me, it was, holy cow, I can now go gluten-free without a problem. For a number of people, it's whatever's out there in the zeitgeist. It made a difference.
Yeah.
Cage-free. We talked about cage-free.
Yeah.
And at that particular time, there was maybe one brand that you could find in a supermarket. And you go to Safeway, you couldn't find any cage-free chicken. Now half of it is.
My mom lays cage-free eggs these days. Yeah, I mean, they're everywhere. Not everybody can change in the same ways. So the suggestion of my book is, let's try not to eat animal products for breakfast and lunch, and then eat the dinner that you're going to eat. That's based on the most comprehensive analysis of the relationship between food and climate change, where the authors studied food systems around the globe and argued that in order to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accords, people who live in undernourished parts of the world can afford to eat a little bit more meat and dairy, but people who live in the UK, Europe, and the United States need to reduce their meat consumption by 90% and their dairy by 60%. Not everyone can do that. In fact, probably most people don't feel like they can do that right now, but that's what we want to be aiming toward. So, you know, as I said, different kinds of change are difficult for different people. So I find it relatively easy to change my diet, not effortless, but relatively easy. If you were to present me with the information about how bad my flying habits are, I would be really embarrassed. And I would tell you I find that much more difficult to change. Some people in this country live in urban food deserts, and we cannot expect them to change at all because they have literally no choice or no options. And that's a problem that we need to work on and solve rather than point at and say, that's why I'm not going to change, even though I have all the ability in the world to change what I eat.
We change for different reasons, too. I used to drive into San Francisco all the time, and now I only take BART because I don't want to sit in traffic. That changed me.
Right. So a lot of people are eating less meat now simply for health. They don't really care about animal welfare, and they don't care about the environment. The argument against eating a lot of meat, I'm not talking about the argument for vegetarianism, but the argument to eat less meat is comprehensive. I mean, there is no argument for eating more meat. People who smoke are three times as likely to get cancer as people who don't smoke. People who eat a meat-based diet are four times as likely to get cancer as people who eat a plant-based diet. We know that it's better for our bodies. This is not controversial. We know that it's better for the environment. It's not controversial. We know it's better for animal welfare. It's not controversial. We also know it's better for farmers. You know, when I wrote Eating Animals, I can't remember when in the process of that publication you and I spoke, but one of the things that most surprised me was who the allies of the book were and who the critics were. I had anticipated that the allies would be like the animal rights community and that the critics would be farmers. And it's actually just the opposite, just the opposite. Farmers despise the factory farming industry, which produces 99.9% of the animals that we eat in America. We have fewer farmers in America right now. I don't mean as a percentage of the population, but a real number. Fewer farmers now than we had during the Civil War, even though the population has increased 11 times. The goal of factory farming is to remove farmers from the equation and to remove nature from the equation. They see a human presence and the model of nature as obstacles to be overcome. So there are a lot of reasons to change. You know, somebody asked me the other day, don't you think it's a little cynical that companies are now starting to sell plant-based meats like Kentucky Fried Chicken or Burger King. I said, who cares? Like, who cares what their motivations are? In the climate conversation, we put the emphasis on feelings and intentions rather than accomplishments. And I'm a good example of this. Like, I, for years, just said all the right things. Like, I know how you opine at a dinner party, and I know the statistics to fire off, and I can make really clever posters at the marches. And I did nothing. And my carbon footprint was way bigger than that of the average denier of climate science, you know? But I found some, like, soothing or complacency in knowing, as if knowing mattered, as if agreeing with the science mattered. I felt that saying somebody has to do something was itself doing something. And this writing this book was a real reckoning in that way.
Oh, you take, I guess, personal blame for having hamburgers.
What I take personal blame for is my own hypocrisy. There's nothing exactly wrong with having hamburgers. I wouldn't say that somebody who eats hamburgers is bad. I would say that somebody who eats hamburgers every day is not living in an environmentally conscious way and is probably killing himself as well. But the point isn't to be perfectly consistent or to aim for some kind of ethical perfection that no one's going to attain and that also isn't necessary. You know, to save the planet, we don't have to stop flying and stop driving and stop eating burgers. We just have to do a lot less of those things. We have to listen to the science. To what the science is pretty clear about how much less of those things we have to do.
You're listening to an interview with Jonathan Safran Foer, whose book is titled We Are the Weather, Saving the Planet Begins at Breakfast. And we're talking about that kind of literally here. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. I have a friend who's a meat eater. His mother's a vegan. His boyfriend is a vegetarian. He eats less meat because he's not around it as much. Mm. I mean, it just changes.
Well, that's what's going to happen. That is the kind of systemic change that I hope for. You know, I don't think there's a future in which meat is illegal or people are shamed when they eat meat. I do think there's a world in which the default switches. So right now, you go to a cafeteria, you go to a restaurant, and they, you know, here's what they're serving, and then here's the veggie option. And what I hope for is a day in the very near future when here's what they're serving and here's the meat option. If you want to eat meat, that's fine. But make it easier for people to eat other things. Another really powerful way to make it easier would to have the price we pay for meat at the cash register reflect the actual price of meat, which is not what we're paying at the cash register because so many of the costs have been externalized. There's massive subsidies to animal agriculture, which we pay for. It's just we don't pay for it at the cash register, so it's an invisible cost to us, and the environmental destruction, which they're not held accountable for.
Jonathan Safran Foer, you talk a lot about Felix Frankfurter and a man named Karski in the book. Now, Karski came over from Europe, and he got to the Supreme Court justice, and he told him about the death camps or the concentration camps in, like, early 1940s. Frankfurter believed him but didn't believe him.
Yeah, so Karski was a young Catholic in the Polish underground who smuggled himself into the Warsaw Ghetto and smuggled himself into a death camp to gather testimonies and evidence. He smuggled himself out of Nazi-occupied Poland, made his way to England and ultimately America to enlighten the world and to get the world to act, to get the West to act. And he had a meeting, a famous meeting with Felix Frankfurter, who was a Supreme Court justice at the time and is considered sort of one of the smartest people America's ever produced. Also a Jew, which is not unimportant in this story. So Karski laid out for Frankfurter what it is that he had seen. He showed him images. He read him testimonies. Frankfurter peppered him with questions like, well, what's the height of the wall that separates the Jews from the rest of the city? And then Frankfurter thought, walked around, sat in his chair and said, look, a man like me speaking to a man like you has to be frank. And I can't believe what you're telling me. And Karski's colleague who was in the room said, how can you say that? Look at all of this evidence. It's irrefutable. And why on earth would he lie? And Frankfurter said, well, I didn't say that he was lying. I said that I'm unable to believe him. My mind and my heart were built in such a way that I cannot believe him. And I think that's a predicament that a lot of us find ourselves in with climate change. You know, we have this impression that about half the country doesn't believe in the science of climate change. And if we could just like shake some sense into their heads, we could get to work on this problem. It's not the case. 91% of Americans accept the science of climate change. 70% of Americans wished that the United States had remained in the Paris Climate Accords. That includes the majority of Republicans. This is not enlightened versus ignorant people. The real kind of denial that's a problem now is the kind that I have had and continue often to have, which is, I know it's true that this is happening. I know the causes. I care about the fact that it's happening. And yet I can't quite believe it in the sense of having my conscience shaken over time. You know, when I'm looking at images of the Amazon burning, or when I'm, you know, watching a superstorm approach the coast, or hearing stories about climate refugees or melting ice sheets, I'm really moved. I feel alarmed. I feel angry. I feel depressed. I feel motivated. And then the second that I'm not actively confronting those realities, I just stop caring. And I go back to my life. And I think, what would be a cool place to fly to for no reason at all, you know? So the form of denial that's most insidious right now is people who know and care but aren't acting. My reason for wanting to write this book was to look at my own disbelief that in that sense, and to question what's possible, not only in terms of what can one do in the world, but also just what is possible for me, because there are a lot of things one can do and should do that are just impossible for us.
When you talk about this, I think about all of the people complaining about Trump who voted for Jill Stein because, well, they just couldn't vote for Hillary, and yet the result was Donald Trump.
Well, the result was Donald Trump. Donald Trump may be remembered as the most important environmentalist who ever lived. The environmental movement as it exists right now is so much stronger than it was 2 years ago. His complete ignorance has forced a kind of wisdom on the rest of us. His apathy has forced a kind of action. It's almost Marxist. Like, he has made the situation so bad that it is finally intolerable. You know, I campaigned for Hillary and I wanted Hillary to be president. I certainly voted for Hillary. If Hillary had been president, we would still be in the Paris Climate Accords. And like every country in Europe, and like all but two countries in the world, we would not meet its goals. The problem is, we would probably feel complacent, you know, because the name of our country was on the line on the right document, and that would feel like enough. Dramatic, radical change is required, and it may be that a negative stimulus is the second best thing to a positive one.
Well, I keep thinking of that picture of Greta Thunberg staring at Donald Trump the other day and thinking she wouldn't be there staring at a Hillary Clinton.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And her voice might not be as powerful.
That's right. And our situation wouldn't be very different. You know, without a doubt, Trump is dismantling extremely important regulations and setting us on a bad course. But relative to the scale of climate change, I don't know how different a Clinton administration would have been.
Jonathan Safran Foer, you bring up in We Are the Weather, you bring up the mobilization required for World War II, shutting out the lights, even in the Midwest, people sacrificing. Now, obviously, we're not at that point now. You also bring up tangentially how the wave starts at baseball games, and the two are related. The question is there a wave? Could there be a wave that at some point would create the environment for a World War II type situation?
It's happening right now.
You think?
I mean, I absolutely do. It feels so palpable. You know, it's easy to get used to the moment that you're living in, but 2 months ago, I think this felt completely different. Let's take just the issue of food, because it happens to be the subject of this book. When I started writing this book, I couldn't find an article connecting meat eating with climate change in a mainstream publication. Now, there's one every single day. Just in the last 2 days, there's one in the New York Times about how omnivores get vegetarian cooking wrong, and here are some ways to get it right. It was written by one of their food journalists whose child became a vegetarian. There's a piece in the New Yorker about the ascendancy of the Beyond Burger and Impossible Burger and what role they might play in battling climate change. There's an article in The Telegraph about a barrister who wants to label meat eating an eco-crime, I think it was. It runs the gamut. There's a lot of stuff out there. Some of it is eye-opening and some of it makes one chuckle. But the volume of coverage it's been increasing parabolically. The volume of energy, and not only among students, I don't know if you feel this way too, but my peers, has been increasing parabolically. You know, if I had written this book a year or two ago, I suppose we'd probably be talking because we like each other and we've had good conversations in the past, but I doubt you would find it as interesting a subject, or certainly not as topical a subject as it is right now. This is just, it is on people's minds, and the challenge is to move it from our minds to our hands, you know, to start doing something and acting and mobilizing. I hope and I think it's what we're on the verge of.
Well, one thing I noticed, I was at Safeway yesterday, and I noticed that the price of the Beyond Burger had risen. The reason for that is that there was now a Safeway brand. The only reason they do that, and I would assume Costco will probably be doing something in the next year or two, is because people are buying them.
Yeah, it's very, very good business. I mean, Beyond had, I think, the most successful IPO in the last 15 years. But it's really interesting why they're being so successful. When I saw images, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken came out with I don't even know what the right nomenclature is, a veggie chicken in Atlanta. They're going to roll it out nationally. They started in Atlanta, and there was an article about it in the Times, and there were images of people around the block. So I didn't look at that and say, the future is now. I looked at it and I thought, that's a lot of vegetarians, you know, who are going to eat this thing. But what I found really inspiring, two things. One, KFC painted their restaurant green that day. So it wasn't just a concession to a small part of the population that they might be able to squeeze a few bucks out of. They were really proudly announcing this new product and announcing the connection to the environment. And their public statement is the part that had me most excited, which was, we don't think of this as a food for vegetarians. We think of this as a food for people, for meat eaters who want to eat less meat. Beyond Burgers, 90% of people who buy Beyond Burgers in supermarkets also buy meat in the same period of time that they conducted that study. I don't know if you feel this way. I'd be curious to hear your experiences, but I know many, many more meat eaters than I know vegetarians. I don't actually know that many vegetarians. Every meat eater I know is interested in eating less meat. They're not interested in becoming vegetarians. So that is a huge change. We used to believe that we had these sort of binary options. You know, you're a vegetarian or you eat meat. That's it. Like, you're one or the other. And people who were anywhere in between were hypocrites. Like, oh, what do you mean? You believe that we should eat less, but you're still eating it? And now I think it's reorienting from an identity and an identifier to a daily choice, or three times a day choice. One in three Americans eats a meal every single day at a fast food restaurant. If all we did was replace fast food meat with plant-based meat, it'd be such a wonderful change in our culture.
Jonathan Safran Foer, one final question. You started work on your next novel then?
I have, but that's to say nothing at all. I start lots and lots and lots of novels. You know that old Mark Twain quote about quitting smoking is the easiest thing in the world to do? I've done it 35 times. There's one thing that's easier, which is starting a novel.
How far are you in the latest iteration then?
In my mind or on the page or?
Well, in your mind, really.
In my mind, I'm done. On the page, I haven't even started. Problem is, everything that seems like a good idea isn't a good idea. You know, that's my experience with writing. Through the process of writing, I figure out what it is that I want to write. Anytime I've ever said, you know what would make a great novel? It hasn't even made a good paragraph. So I no longer have much, I have zero faith and very little interest in my good ideas. Your listeners can't see me making the little air quotes. But the further I get into my life as a writer, the more excited I am by process.
So the next step is to begin to write and see where it goes?
That's exactly what the next step is, yeah. After
the tour.
After the tour. You know, I want to keep working. I want to devote more time to advocacy. when I wrote this book, I thought of it only as a book. And I've decided that I want to devote real time, like a couple days a week, to continuing to act, not only through words, but through action, on this problem, which is immediate and urgent and demands the most that we can give it.
Which is trying to stop further climate change.
That's right.
You've been listening to an interview with Jonathan Safran Foer, whose latest book is We Are the Weather, Saving the Planet Begins at Breakfast. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. For comments about this program, write bookwaves@hotmail.com. And for more information, go to bookwaves.com. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bolse Radio Presents, our virtual action fundraiser, Con la Bolse Ferme, The Power of Our Voice, on Saturday, September 12th, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., streaming online. This virtual event celebrates the work of community leaders and victories in the movement for immigrant and workers' rights. Again, that's Bolse Radio Presents, our virtual auction fundraiser, Con la Bolse Ferme, The Power of Our Voice, on Saturday, September 12th, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the